are listening to the Worldwide Freedom Radio Network.
This is my daddy's station. I'm Pooh, classic radio like you always wished it could be. 101.1 FM, eager.
Having a hard time finding your favorite show on shortwave or satellite? The Christian Media Newspaper now provides program guides to all the top Christian, patriot, and alternative radio programs. Four times a year, they print an updated shortwave and satellite program guide. Christian Media is $20 per year and includes news and interviews on Christian books, video, music, and broadcasting. Subscribe now and receive a free Christian music compact disc with your paid order. To subscribe to Christian Media or receive more information, call 520-333-4578. Once again, to subscribe to Christian Media or receive more information, call 520-333-4578. That's 520-333-4578. Call now.
101.1 FM is owned and operated by the Independence Foundation Trust as a nonprofit community service.
You're listening to the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper, the man President William Jefferson Clinton named as the most dangerous radio host in the nation. And today you're going to discover another reason why. We're going to continue with our reading of Relevance magazine. And it's all about how the establishment, otherwise known as the Communist News Networks, print, radio, television, I don't care, never tell the truth. They are the most consummate chronic liars that have ever probably existed upon the face of this earth. And this article says it extremely well, tells it exactly like it is, and puts it in an arena that anyone can understand quickly and easily. So, we will be continuing with that today. And I hope that all of you heard yesterday's broadcast and will continue taking notes or whatever you have to do to make sure that you digest this information, because it's important. At least I think it's important. And from the feedback from yesterday's broadcast, many of you do also. In fact, I heard comments that, it was one of the best broadcasts we've ever done. But don't give me the credit, folks. I'm reading it from the pages of Relevance magazine, published by the Relevance Corporation. Philip M. O'Halloran, my good friend, is the editor. And if you'd like a subscription, he doesn't even know I'm doing this, folks. I'm not getting any money for this. I do this all the time. If I think something is worth it, I tell my listening audience about it, and I tell you where you can get it. A regular subscription is $110. It's $110, worth every penny of it. And you can call 1-800-626-8944 if you'd like to have a copy. That's 1-800-626-8944 and order your own personal copy of Relevance magazine. Don't go away. I'll be right back in just a few seconds or maybe a minute or two to continue with the reading of The Truth Steps Out, The End of Blind Trust in the Media.
and Dr. Frog.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. The Pledge of Allegiance to the flag and the pledge to the ideals of our forefathers, the men who fought and died in the building of this great nation. It's a pledge to fulfill our duties and obligations as citizens of the United States and to uphold the principles of our Constitution. And last but not least, it's a pledge to maintain the four great freedoms cherished by all Americans. Freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom from want, and freedom from fear. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, to the republic for which it stands, one nation.
I bet you believe in the myth of the free press also. There's no such thing as a free press, ladies and gentlemen, at least not for you. Only for the owner. And only if the owner doesn't owe anything to anyone else or doesn't depend upon advertising of large corporations or the political machinations of whatever party or group they belong to. And that just, folks, happens to be the truth. Well, against the backdrop of everything that I read to you yesterday, of subtle economic fascism and the trend toward an increasingly totalitarian society controlled by the corporate government duopoly, it's not hard to understand why the corporate media isn't particularly interested in informing you about any of the following. That Timothy McVeigh may have been working as a government agent on April 19, 1995. And yes, you heard me say it right. There is evidence that points directly to that being the case. That the botched raid at Ruby Ridge was the FBI-sanctioned murder of an Idaho family that just wanted to be left alone. That the FBI deliberately shot and or incinerated 86 men, women, and children at Waco, Texas on April the 19th, 1993. And we'll cover that, or at least portions of it. That the CIA is heavily involved in the drug trade, both here and around the world, for motives ranging from profit to the increased governmental control that results from the phony war on drugs. That a missile brought down TWA Flight 800 off Long Island on July 17, 1996. Who fired the missile? Nobody knows. That the Clinton administration and the Democratic Party were penetrated by Chinese intelligence. Let me say that again. That the Clinton administration and the Democratic Party were penetrated by Chinese intelligence and sold United States economic and geopolitical favors in return for laundered red Chinese campaign contributions in the 1996 elections. That the United States election system counts a majority of our votes with computers provided by a handful of shadowy election service companies, and that the source codes are not under the control of election officials, but of the election service companies, which enjoy proprietary control of the software which counts your vote, and these companies are owned by ABC, CBS, and NBC, although we don't even know these firms exist. We are letting them count our votes on the honor system. That is, you don't know these firms exist. That White House independent counsel Vincent Foster was either murdered or, in the unlikely event that he committed suicide, his body was moved from the original site to Fort Marcy Park. But all of the evidence points to murder. That Foster's death was only the most controversial of several dozens, that's right, I said dozens, of individuals closely linked to Bill Clinton, either as political associates, friends, foes, or witnesses to alleged Clinton-related crimes, who, over the past 6 years, have met their deaths by an odd mix of suspicious suicides, plane crashes, car accidents, falls, and murder. Statisticians cringe when they even attempt to compute the odds that this could ever happen. That the FBI crime lab has for years falsified evidence used in thousands of federal prosecutions, including a number of high-profile cases such as the Oklahoma bombing, the 1989 bombing death of a federal judge in Atlanta, and the World Trade Center bombing, and many, many more, and no telling how many countless of innocent people are in jail because they were framed by this phony information from this phony FBI crime lab, which is itself criminal. That Bill Clinton's Arkansas was and remains as corrupt as some of the more wretched third world countries. And this, ladies and gentlemen, is exemplified by the unconscionable cover-ups of the deaths of two boys on a railroad track outside Little Rock after they had apparently witnessed a drug plane drop believed to be linked with the MENA, Arkansas cocaine smuggling operation of the Central Intelligence Agency. The investigation of their deaths and those of the more than half a dozen other witnesses which followed were blatantly suppressed by officials high in the Arkansas State House and the United States Justice Department and the Federal Bureau of Investigation and, yes, William Jefferson Clinton. That surveillance cameras being installed on street corners around the country and Federal Bureau of Investigation initiatives to wire trap, that's right, wire trap, wiretap, but it is wiretrap, or track millions of private phone conversations, are turning the country into an Orwellian police state. And if you think it's nice that you have this little call tracking thing in your house where when somebody calls, it tells you what number it is and who they are and all that kind of stuff. Well, folks, if you can do that with a little gadget in your home, the FBI or the government can do that for everybody and every phone call throughout the nation. And it's mandated by law that when telephone companies put in new equipment, they put in the equipment that will allow them to do this. They have no choice under the law. Now, if the phone company only operated phones within a state, they could tell them to go take a hike, but they don't. That microchips really are being designed for implantation into people for the purposes of tracking them and providing portable electronic bank accounts for the coming cashless society? You think it's wild, far out? You think that that's lunatic fringe stuff? Well, folks, you have not yet tasted of the banquet of technology that has been developed, is being developed, and is ready for use at the present time. But we have, and we'll keep you posted on it. That powerful totalitarian forces within our society desire a disarmed America in which the private ownership of guns is outlawed and the monopoly of force rests in government hands. That federal agents, provocateurs, routinely infiltrate militias and other so-called, quote, anti-government, end quote, organizations with the express intent to illegally entrap and frame them, just as the FBI's COINTELPRO agents did to the left in the 60s and 70s, even going so far as to murder the leadership of the Black Panther Party. In each of these travesties, the common denominator, ladies and gentlemen, is the major media's practice of ignoring, obfuscating, or actively discrediting anything which might indicate U.S. government wrongdoing, corruption, or treason. In recent years, it has become almost too obvious that they are running interference for the government. Before he died, columnist Warren Brooks noted that we are plagued with not so much a liberal media as a status media. He explained that it tends always toward a defense of governmental power, not only because of the Leviathan-loving mentality of today's journalists, but because reporters who cover a given government beat are denied access by Washington bureaucrats if their coverage is unflattering to the agencies involved. These same bureaucrats will punish a too nosy investigative reporter by sending news tidbits and so-called scoops, actually just more light news and pablum, to the reporter's competition. In this way, an obedient media builds its coverage on the official lines spoon-fed to it by the press relations apparatus of each governmental agency. In fact, tens of thousands of government employees earn their money by writing press releases, which are dispensed almost in their original form with very little checking or alteration by wire services and newspapers to a public which thinks it is reading the final product of in-depth reporting, and nothing could be farther from the truth. In fact, CBS anchor Connie Chung admitted precisely that on the Johnny Carson show several years ago, stating that they often simply repeat verbatim the government press releases handed to them by the various agencies. This slothful practice led to a self-flagellation by mainstream journalists in Arizona last year, who, after coaxing from Congressman Jim Kolb, admitted that they had been burned by federal spin controllers in the ridiculously overblown and distorted, quote, Viper Militia, end quote, case. But the National Press Gang still hadn't learned its lesson when it swallowed whole the leaked FBI disinformation that security guard Richard Jewell was the Olympic Park bomber. This led to multiple lawsuits, which cost NBC News and others large settlements. From the beginning, the official story of the Oklahoma City bombing stretched the credulity of even the least thoughtful observers. We had a man fleeing the bombing with a license plate conveniently missing from his vehicle, providing a red flag, begging the police to pull him over. And when this happened, the alleged killer of 168 inexplicably failed to make it 169 by turning his gun on the lone state trooper, not giving any resistance whatsoever. Later, local Oklahoma television reporters interviewed half a dozen people who had seen McVeigh in their Oklahoma City establishments as recently as 2 days before the bombing, eating or drinking beer with foreign-accented men who appeared Middle Eastern, an Iraqi who had been allowed into this country along with thousands of other Iraqi Gulf War prisoners, was positively identified from a photo lineup by a young woman who maintains that he almost ran her over as he drove away from the Alfred P. Mura building just minutes before the bomb went off. When relevance asked NBC Nightly News why it wasn't reporting on these major breakthroughs, spokesman Jeff Ross said they planned to run it, quote, at some future time, we'll use it when we have to, end quote. That was the summer of 1995, and folks, we're still waiting. The official FBI line that a single truck bomb had destroyed the building was itself obliterated within weeks of the blast by top explosives expert Brigadier General Benson K. Parton, United States Air Force retired. Unfortunately, Parton holds the distinction of being one of the most important debunkers of a government lie to have consistently escaped national media attention. General Parton tells us that this may change soon with the upcoming broadcast of a segment he taped for the TV magazine Extra, but we'll see about that also. And now the analysis of the forthright military man has been corroborated by a report written by a demolition expert, John Culbertson, utilizing test results provided by the Air Force's Armament Directorate Wright Laboratory at Elgin Air Force Base in Florida. The report, entitled Case Study Relating Blast Effects, Tests to the Events of April 19, 1995, Alfred P. Mura Building, Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, involved the analysis of Air Force data from the intentional demolition of a test structure with construction characteristics similar to those of the Mura Building. Culbertson concluded, quote, due to these conditions, relating to the inefficiency of air blast in destroying reinforced concrete columns, it is impossible to ascribe the damage that occurred on April 19, 1995, to a single truck bomb containing 4,800 pounds of ammonium nitrate and fuel oil mixture. And he said, quote, it must be concluded that the damage at the Mura Federal Building is not the result of the truck bomb itself, but rather due to other factors such as locally placed charges within the building itself, end quote. This is an official Pentagon military report. Too bad Stephen Jones didn't have a copy of that report in his defense of Timothy McVeigh. You see, this goes much farther, much deeper than any of you have ever imagined. In addition, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, released a study on August 30, 1996, entitled, quote, The Oklahoma City Bombing Improved Buildings' Performance Through Multi-Hazard Mitigation, end quote, designed to find ways of improving the survivability of federal buildings in terrorist attacks. The study inadvertently supplied data which undermines the official Justice Department contention that 4,800 pounds of ANFO fertilizer and fuel oil blew up the Mura Building. It includes calculations showing that in order to create a crater the size of the one in Oklahoma City, the bombers would have had to use approximately three times the amount of fertilizer allegedly used in the attack. The prosecution's single bomber theory maintains that Tim McVeigh was the only actual bomber. Terry Nichols is alleged to have helped him with the construction of the device while remaining in Kansas on the day of the bombing. They have officially relegated John Doe number 2 to the status of a man who never was, but we know that he existed, and I've talked about on this broadcast, I saw him with my own eyes with a man who looked identical to Timothy McVeigh, except a few years younger. We've also seen a photograph of a member of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, who is also an exact double of Tim McVeigh, only again, he looks a little younger, just like the man that I saw. This has all been reported to the FBI, who doesn't even want to hear it, doesn't care about any of it. They're not interested in justice or catching who really did this, because they don't want anybody to know who really did it. The Washington Post cooperated with this deception by comparing the myth of John Doe 2 to the Loch Ness Monster. That's why the feds are taking the extraordinary measure of dispensing with every witness who claims to have seen McVeigh inside the state of Oklahoma on the day of the bombing. And you know why they won't listen to my eyewitness testimony and the testimony of others who have seen John Doe number 2, exactly as pictured in the FBI releases, with Timothy McVeigh, or a Timothy McVeigh double? Because in every instance, ladies and gentlemen, it was also noticed by these witnesses, me included, and also reported to the Federal Bureau of Investigation, that these two men were under surveillance at the time. That's right. under surveillance by government operatives in government cars. These otherwise excellent witnesses all suffer from one fatal flaw. They all claim to have seen McVeigh with someone else. But this would open up the possibility that there were other bombers still on the loose. The reason this would be embarrassing to the government is that, as we have pointed out in the past, John Doe No. 2 and others seen with McVeigh have been federal operatives, all of them, tightly linked to the intelligence community. And most of them have already been identified, ladies and gentlemen. Their names are known, their addresses are known, and their whereabouts are known. But the feds are left with the tainted evidence of fuse residue. Fuse residue on McVeigh's clothing, which, guess what? Came out of the discredited FBI crime lab, and the testimony of employees at Elliott's Body Shop in Kansas who claimed that McVeigh rented a Ryder truck just prior to the bombing. And one of those individuals, Tom Kessinger, has changed his story several times and has an added credibility problem. You see, he has several prior felonies on his record. An even greater problem with the Elliott's Body Shop testimony is that the description of the renter who used the alias Clean was of a man who was 5 foot 10 inches tall and 185 pounds with green eyes, a rough face with bad acne, and a crooked or deformed jaw. That does not describe Timothy McVeigh. Timothy McVeigh stands 6 foot 2 inches and weighs only 165 pounds and has blue eyes, a clear complexion, and a straight jaw. The government is left with the circumstantial evidence provided by the testimony of people like Mike and Lori Fortier, who were under constant, intense pressure for 2 years from the FBI involving terrifying threats of long prison terms or worse. Unless we forget, Michael Fortier's original statement on national TV regarding McVeigh was, quote, "No way did Tim blow up that building," end quote. And, not to mention, Michael and Lori Fortier are both hardcore drug addicts. Admitted, by the way. Admitted in court under oath. And in the meantime, the independent press has accumulated massive evidence of federal foreknowledge of an impending terrorist attack in the months, weeks, and days prior to the assault. For starters, federal agents in Colorado granted a letter of immunity from prosecution to federal informant Gary Kagan, who warned them repeatedly of a pending plot hatched by an odd mix of Middle Eastern and American terrorists to bomb a federal building in the Denver area. Recruited to transport explosives for Middle Eastern terrorists, Kagan claimed that in a March 17, 1995 meeting in Colorado, Hezbollah bombers laid out plans of the targeted Alfred P. near a federal building in Oklahoma City. An alarmed Kagan sent urgent warnings to federal agents in Denver, which culminated in an April 6th letter in which he stated, quote, "I have specific information that within 2 weeks a federal building is to be bombed in this area or nearby," end quote. 13 days later, the Mirror Building in the adjoining state of Oklahoma was reduced to a smoldering shell. Yet no one at the FBI followed the leads of this prophetic informant. Kagan is now suing the federal government for violating its immunity agreement with him and for releasing his identity, thus barring him to the tender mercies of the men he had exposed. Meanwhile, those men remain free and clear. And once again, as in the Kennedy assassination, we are given the lone crazed bomber. And it's just another crock of crap. Another informant working for the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms warned that a plot to destroy a federal building was being hatched at Robert Millar's Christian Identity enclave known as Elohim City in southwestern Oklahoma. And we'll get to that right after this.
My country is of thee, sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. Land where my father died, land of the pilgrim's guide, from every mountain side, let freedom ring. My native country be land.
Hey, call now.
Having a hard time finding your favorite show on shortwave or satellite? The Christian Media Newspaper now provides program guides to all the top Christian, patriot, and alternative radio programs. Four times a year, they print an updated shortwave and satellite program guide. Christian Media is only $20 a year and includes news and interviews on Christian books, video, music, and broadcasting. Subscribe now and receive a free Christian music compact disc with your paid order. To subscribe to Christian Media or receive more information, call 520-333-4578. Once again, to subscribe to Christian Media or receive more information, call 520-333-4578. That's 520-333-4578. Call now.
Thy name I love. I love thy rocks and hills, thy woods and templed hills. My heart with rapture thrills like that above. Let mortal tongues away, let all that grieve partake, let rocks their silence break the sound. Our Father's God to thee, author of liberty, to thee we sing. Long may our land be bright with freedom's holy light. Take us by thy might, great God, our King.
Amen to that. I wish that I could hasten him doing that a little bit, but God works in mysterious ways and in his own pace. And to tell you quite honestly, ladies and gentlemen, I don't think God's going to help us in any way unless we're helping ourselves. We may just deserve what's happening to us. Carol Howe. Well, wait a minute. Before I continue with the relevance article, let me do something that I promised you I would do yesterday. That is, give you the schedule, the immediate schedule, within the next couple or 3 months, for the showing of Waco, the Rules of Engagement. And this is the latest update, dated May 31st, 1997. It will be showing at Rice University, 2030 University Boulevard, Houston, Texas, 77005, from June 6th through the 8th. Or maybe it's just June 6th and 8th. I don't know if this means 6th through the 8th or 6th and 8th. What I have here is Rice University. Waco, the Rules of Engagement will be showing at Rice University, 2030 University Boulevard in Houston, Texas, June 6th, and then I have a dash 8, whatever that means. Then I have Human Rights Watch Film Festival, Lincoln Center, New York, New York. That's the Human Rights Watch Film Festival, Lincoln Center, New York, New York. Also showing June 6 and 8. The Cinema... got my tongue twisted around my wisdom tooth there. The Cinema Village, 594 Broadway, New York, New York. Showing daily, June 13th through the 20th. And the end date is tentative, may go longer than that. The Cinema Village, 594 Broadway, New York, New York, 10012, showing daily, June 13th through the 20th, and it may go longer. But don't count on it. Get in there and see it. The Florida Film Festival, Maitland, Florida. We don't have any details as to the address where it is, but it'll be showing on June 18th at the Florida Film Festival in Maitland, Florida. Call the Maitland, Florida Chamber of Commerce, and they'll probably be able to give you the address of where the Florida Film Festival is going to be held. Again, it will be showing on June 18th. The Tower Theater, 876 East 900 South Street. That's the Tower Theater, 876 East 900 South Street, Salt Lake City, Utah, showing June 20th. That's June 20th. The Key Theater, 1325 and a half, Wisconsin Avenue Northwest, Washington, D.C. That's the Key Theater, 1325 and a half, Wisconsin Avenue Northwest, Washington, D.C. Be showing daily, June 20th through the 27th. Again, the end date is tentative, could go longer depending on how many people show up to see it. The Coolidge Corner, Brookline, Massachusetts. The Coolidge Corner, Brookline, Massachusetts, showing daily June 27th through July 4th. That's June 27th through July 4th. The Magic Theater, I like the name of that one, don't you? The Magic Theater, Nevada City, California, showing daily July 4th through the 7th. July 4th through the 7th. The University Village Cinemaster Theaters, the University Village Cinemaster Theaters, 1201 University Avenue, Riverside, California, showing in September. We don't have the exact dates. Call the theater and they'll be happy to tell you. That's the University Village Cinemaster Theaters, 1201 University Avenue, Riverside, California. Call the theater. It'll be showing in September. We don't have the exact dates. We'll also be showing at the Denver Film Festival, Denver, Colorado. We will give you the address as soon as we get it. October 23rd. Somewhere between October 23rd and the 30th. We don't know the exact date. So, that fulfills the promise that I made to you yesterday. Go see it. If it's in your area, go see it. If it's in your area, go see this film. Please. Carol Howe, 24, had been accepted into the obscure sect through a relationship with white Aryan resistance leader Dennis Mahan and warned that Mahan and an alleged German neo-Nazi named Andreas Strassmeier who is really an intelligence operative of the German Intelligence Organization and the Central Intelligence Agency, who also lived at the commune, were instigating violence against federal targets. Mayen called the charges a big lie. Strassmeier has admitted to meeting McVeigh once at a gun show, and McVeigh was reportedly pulled over for speeding once a few miles outside Elohim City. Someone using McVeigh's phone card also telephoned the premises before the bombing and asked for Strassmeier, according to residents there. Strassmeier, a former German military intelligence officer and the son of a prominent member of the staff of German Chancellor Helmut Kohl, admitted to London's Sunday Telegraph reporter Ambrose Evans Pritchard to having contacts with an ex-CIA operative named Vincent Petrusky. The British reporter also printed evidence that Strassmeier wielded diplomatic immunity and shocking statements by the German which strongly suggested that he had been working as a provocateur. These allegations have since been proven time and time again. He all but admitted to Evans Pritchard that the bombing involved a sting operation, which was supposed to end with the arrest of the perpetrators just prior to the detonation of the truck bomb. Carol Howe, whose reliability was evidenced by her passing a dozen lie detector tests, was unknown until early this year. An ABC 2020 investigative team, led by Roger Charles, prepared an in-depth expose on her story, which included an interview with the young ATF informant. According to Charles, network executives scuttled the piece following intense pressure from the Justice Department and Clinton White House. An outraged Roger Charles then called into the national talk radio and television program, The Don Imus Show, and decried the network's craven kowtowing to the government cover-up. The honor-bound reporter was quickly granted his walking papers by ABC. That's right, folks. He was fired for telling the truth. But he regained his job after he began to talk to reporters in the independent media. They rehired him to shut him up. Strassmeier, who was never taken in for questioning by the FBI, returned to Germany, where he once again has resumed his role as a German intelligence operative and CIA agent. The evidence of federal foreknowledge of the bombing is extensive, and although relevance has been covering it since shortly after the bombing, it is worth recapping the hardest evidence. And this is just a sampling, ladies and gentlemen, if you really want to know what happened on April the 19th, 1995. Get Oklahoma City Day One by Michelle Marie Moore, 640 pages of the most solid documentation and sources. It is the American classic of that bombing day. You can order it by calling 1-800-888-9999. That's 1-800-888-9999. It's $34.95, postage paid. That's 1-800-888-9999. $34.95, postage paid, ladies and gentlemen. But here's just some of the hardest evidence. One man who arrived at the blast scene looking for his wife related to Brad Edwards of the local television station, KFOR, that an ATF agent on the scene told him that he and his comrades were, quote, tipped by their pagers not to come into work that day, end quote. 1 month before the bombing, the March 22nd edition of the New Jersey Star-Ledger reported on a U.S. Marshals Service memo warning that, quote, Islamic terrorists may be planning suicide attacks against federal courthouses and government installations in the United States, end quote. The memo warned of a, quote, sufficient threat potential, end quote, to warrant a, quote, heightened level of security awareness and caution, end quote. As we reported, in September 1995, the Oklahoma City Fire Department headquarters received a call on April 14th from the FBI warning of a possible terrorist attack. One witness recalled seeing a huge convoy of fire trucks, lights and sirens blaring, heading straight for the nearby Mura building just seconds before it exploded. Witnesses claim that a bomb squad entered the building 3 hours before the blast on an apparent security check, and there are many witnesses who saw that and who saw the bomb squad truck in the parking lot. Wayne Alley, the original judge appointed to the bombing case, was removed when the defense cited conflict of interest because his office was damaged and one of his staffers injured in the blast. Alley himself had escaped injury because he wasn't there. On April 20th, the day after the blast, he admitted to his hometown Oregon newspaper, the Portland Oregonian, that he had been working out of his home that day because just a few weeks before the attack, he had been told by security officials to, quote, take extra precautions, end quote, and to be, quote, on the lookout for people casing homes or wondering about in the courthouse who aren't supposed to be there, letter bombs. There has been an increased vigilance, end quote. Now, there are few conspiracy theories that have as much hard evidence behind them as does the one suggesting that Vince Foster was murdered. Here are the facts which proved so uncomfortable for CBS's 60 Minutes that Mike Wallace and company preferred to focus on attacking ex-New York Post reporter Chris Ruddy, the man who brought so many of them to light. The deputy White House counsel is found dead in Fort Marcy Park from a gunshot to the head. There is a surprisingly small amount of blood at the scene, almost none, as a matter of fact. The gun is still in his hand, despite the fact that the recoil almost always propels the pistol several feet away from the suicide victim. On the other hand, his glasses are found over 20 feet from his body. There are no fingerprints on the gun, which is a composite piece put together using parts from more than one gun. This type of weapon is commonly called a throwaway and is usually carried by police officers and intelligence operatives. Foster's family states that he didn't own the gun. In addition, the autopsy shows that Foster died with a full stomach, hardly characteristic of a man racked with despair just hours before taking his own life. Semen stains and silky blonde hairs are found in his underwear, and carpet fibers are found all over his body, introducing the possibility that the body had been rolled up in a carpet after his death and carried to the park. This is supported by the fact that his shoes show no dust or dirt on them. Despite the inability of even skeptics like Mike Wallace to walk to where the body was found without getting muck all over his loafers. What's more, the police and emergency medical service personnel at the scene searched his clothing, but found no car keys on his person, although his car was there, and there were no keys in his car either. There were no keys anywhere at the scene. White House officials would later find his car keys in his trouser pocket at the morgue. Unsolved Mysteries, one of the rare TV magazines which tends to practice honest, objective journalism, presented a group of experts in handwriting analysis who declared that the alleged suicide note was a forgery. An incredible 6 days after his death, the note had been found in Foster's briefcase, one of the first places investigators should have looked for clues to his death. It had been torn into 27 pieces, with the 28th piece, which would have borne his signature, guess what? Mysteriously missing. One witness even told investigators that there was a man with no shirt on sitting inside Foster's car just hours before his body was found. As we reported last month, one of the star team's investigators, apparently disgruntled by the cover-up, is showing reporters a photograph of Foster's body, which shows another previously undisclosed bullet wound in his neck. These clear indications of foul play have been sidestepped by the major media, which instead trumpets the fact that congressional investigators and independent counsels Robert Fisk and Kenneth Starr have all concluded that Foster killed himself. Since the notion that these investigators could have been compromised is tantamount to a thought crime for members of the National Press Corps, they are bound to conclude that the inconsistencies are mere coincidences. This is inductive reasoning at its most dangerous. Everybody knows that federal investigators would never cover up a murder. Therefore, the inconsistencies must be explained by coincidence. The alternative, for some, is unthinkable, since it would puncture the hallowed myth that there are no conspiracies in high office. Reporters and commentators then pitched their coincidence theory of a Foster suicide as accepted fact. The final stage in this sordid process involves the incessant repetition of the official line and the concomitant smearing of any conspiracy theorist who dares to question it. Over the last 5 years, we've had one FBI disaster after another. Ruby Ridge, Waco, federal cover-ups of the Vince Foster death, the bombing of the World Trade Center in New York, the Oklahoma City bombing, and the Flight 800 disaster punctuate a steady stream of lesser scandals such as the FBI files and Travelgate imbroglios. The arrest of an FBI agent allegedly caught spying for the Russians. The deathbed deposition of an FBI agent who said that a man was framed when the FBI put a bomb in his car and then arrested him for having a bomb in his car and put him in jail. I read that deposition on the air. Deathbed deposition made to a federal judge. The failure to perform national security background checks on White House personnel and shady visitors like Chinese arms dealer Wang Yun and Commerce Department appointee John Huang. With the vindication of Frederick Whitehurst's crime lab allegations, the weight of evidence was too much even for the flagship monthly of the establishment media. And after a relentless 5-year litany of manifest corruption and dereliction of duty at the nation's top federal law enforcement agency, Time Magazine finally published an April 28th cover story, quote, "What's Wrong at the FBI," end quote, trying to discover why we are only now being told about this problem, Relevance asks, quote, "What's wrong at Time Magazine?" end quote. In the September 1995 issue of Relevance, we reported the allegations of the FBI crime lab's top explosives expert, Frederick Whitehurst, who exposed corrupt practices within the lab involving the falsification of evidence and the rewriting of evidentiary reports with a clear slant toward the prosecution. Whitehurst had already become the victim of a vicious and relentless campaign of bureaucratic retaliation, which attempted to paint him as a kook. The story had massive implications, since it called into question the verdicts of a host of high-profile cases, such as the World Trade Center bombing, the 1989 murder of a federal judge in Atlanta, and the Oklahoma City bombing. For example, Whitehurst had stated that he examined Timothy McVeigh's clothing and found no traces of explosives. The clothing was then placed in an area of the lab known to be contaminated with explosive residue. FBI agents then re-examined the garments and, guess what? After storing the garments in an area of the lab where they knew there was explosive residue, after having examined the clothing and found no trace of explosive residue, now they found traces of the explosive material PETN, known as PETN. Agents then testified to this before the grand jury, which had what it thought was the first hard evidence of a direct link between McVeigh and the bombing, evidence they then used to indict him in August of 1995, and which was used to convict him just recently. As we noted 2 months ago, the FBI's attack on Whitehurst backfired when 37 of his fellow employees backed up various aspects of his claims about shoddy lab practices and pressure by superiors to slant evidence in favor of the prosecution. This verifies and confirms what I've been telling you for many years, ladies and gentlemen, that the government and prosecutors and crime labs and most of police department and law enforcement agencies are not interested in justice. They are not interested in finding the true perpetrator of the crime, but only in finding someone whom they can convict and imprison. And it could be you the next time. The Justice Department's Office of the Inspector General then released a report of its 3-year investigation into the allegations of Whitehurst and others and entirely vindicated the veteran scientist. However, the same report inexplicably recommended that Whitehurst not be reinstated to his old job, citing a lack of judgment and common sense because he had revealed the truth to the American public. Such impenetrable illogic, ladies and gentlemen, surpasses the worst nightmares of Franz Kafka. As Ace Hayes, the editor of the Portland Free Press, once observed to this editor, quote, "It's like dealing with the Red Queen in Alice in Wonderland," end quote. And still, we are not finished with this magazine article. With this magazine, as a matter of fact, it only carries one article. We will continue tomorrow. Good night, ladies and gentlemen, and God bless each and every single one of you, and may God in His infinite mercy save this republic.
If tomorrow all the things were gone, work for all my life, and I had to start again with just my children and my wife, I thank my lucky stars to be living here today, but the flag still stands for freedom and they can't take that away. And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free. And I won't forget the men who died, who gave that life to me. And I gladly stand up next to you and it can't hurt you today, but there ain't no doubt I love this man. God bless the USA.
This is the voice of freedom.